All right, now it's time for a little fun. We'd like to do our version of Watermelon Man. Bye, y'all.
Poncho Sanchez, the great conguero, and you might have been able to pick up a bit of Chucho Valdez on piano there, performing live Watermelon Man at the Conga Room in Los Angeles. That's from the Poncho Sanchez Latin Soul album, released in 1999. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Free Your Mind Friday, May the 16th, and what a lot of news this week, lots of stuff that should be swimming around in your head that you have an opinion or two about. This is your time to call in and just share what you're thinking, what's on your mind at 888-874-4888. This is your forum for ideas. And up first, Berkeley. Harvey, you're on the air.
Hello, wonderful Eutrice.
Hello, Harvey. How are you doing out there with all those fires?
Well, there aren't any where I am, but, you know, we're nervous out here because there's no water and things are getting drier and drier, and as we haven't even hit the summer yet. So, yeah, no, it's a scary thing. That's why we have to move away from coal, oil, natural gas, and nuclear, because that's creating the environment for these things to happen. And move to solar and renewable energy. But I'd like to talk about, I'd like to bring us a bit into space here today. And there's, if you go to YouTube, there's a website, and the name of it is Large Scale Structure of the Universe. Did I ever tell you about this, Eutrice?
No.
Okay. Yeah, you have to enter the words large scale, L-A-R-G-E-S-C-A-L-E, Structure, S-T-R-U-C-T-U-R-E, that's a singular, of the universe, large-scale structure of the universe. And this is a NASA production. What they did was they collected all the information from the world's telescopes and Hubble Space Telescope, and they put it all into a computer, and they formulated a picture of the known universe as far as our instruments can go out there, our satellites. And so here you see a picture of the universe as we know it. And what's interesting about it is that as you fly through the universe, there are structures that look like brain neurons. And you can only see them at this scale, if you go to YouTube and put in the words brain neurons, and then look at brain neurons, and then look at large-scale structure of the universe, you'll see it's amazingly similar. So I'm thinking that it could be that our universe is a giant brain, that we're living within a brain, and that maybe dark matter is like gray matter in the brain, and that our brains, you know, they say as above, so below, our brain may be a modem into the universe, into the meta-internet, I call it. And so I feel very connected with the universe. It's not a cold, hostile place to me anymore after looking at large-scale structure of the universe. It seems more like a sort of a biological entity. I don't know. I think I'm having new feelings about this. So I just wanted to let everybody know that there may be more to this than meets the eye. It may be that we're part of something, that we're living inside of something that is living, that's alive. So I just want to put that out there. Large-scale structure of the universe, check it out yourself. There's one that says 7 years old. That's the one to look at. It'll say 7 years old. That's when it was made. And it's incredible. And
I'll take a look. I really will. Large-scale structure of the universe.
Of the universe, right. Large-scale structure of the universe. And it'll say 7 years old. That's the one. And I think you'll be amazed. And also look at brain neurons as well on YouTube.
Thanks a lot, Harvey, for getting us started today.
Thank you.
Thank you. So I'm just writing now, 7 years old. Okay, so I made my notes. 888-874-4888. Well, so much has happened. What's on your mind? What's your take on the news of the day, wherever it is you are, and whatever it is you're thinking is the news of the day? I'm just a traffic cop. That's my role on Fridays, just to direct traffic. I'm not here to give any talks. I did that during the week. So today is your day. It's very, very important, by the way, to engage in discussion and debate. For one thing, it gets you in the habit of exchanging opinions and ideas with people who may or may not agree with you. But that's okay. The main thing is, what is the argument that you're making, and how, you know, what is the journey that brought you to the point where you are in your thinking? Are you thinking the same thing today as you did yesterday? I'm hoping that there's been a little change or metamorphosis as time goes by, that you examine and re-examine your thoughts, and that you're evolving. And your political consciousness, of course, that we continue to add to our reservoir of information, the pieces of knowledge and information that we garner in the course of exchanging views. So this is your forum, and a whole day out of my 5 days belongs to you. So there you go. Make use of it. 888-874-4888. One marvelous thing has happened, and I just wanted to put things in perspective here. We talk about elections. Well, how about 540 million people voting? That's as many people who voted in the May 12th elections in India that just brought a brand new person as head of state forward. His name is Narendra Modi, and there's a great deal of excitement about his election. People are thrilled about the possibility of a new page in India. And this reminds us here in the United States that when we talk about democracy as if we have a monopoly on it, there are places that, I mean, have been going about the business of democracy for a long time and on a much larger scale. And this is part of their typical, quote-unquote, typical experience. This is what they do when they have elections, that it takes this long because millions and millions and millions of people voting more than the population of the United States altogether. And this is what they do. And so when we, you know, when we talk about these things, we should have a sense of perspective. From Baltimore, Green, you're on the air.
Hello, Eutrice. How are you?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
Same as always. I refuse to complain.
Okay.
You know, Eutrice, I just want to reaffirm my feeling, reaffirm to you my feeling that you are the best radio host I've ever heard.
Oh, and, get out of here. Really? So thank you. I should be more gracious.
I told you that the first time I called you, and that hasn't changed.
Thank you.
And I want to say that because it seems that often when I call you, as much as I hate to, I have a little different take on things than you do. So I just want you to know that it has nothing to do, it hasn't altered, you know, my respect for you.
Well, thank you.
But, Eutrice, earlier this week, I believe it was, you were talking about the conversation in the Jewish community as a result of Mr. Sterling's remarks.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I have kind of a different take on it than you presented to us. And I think that the conversation that the Jewish community is having is more of a readjusting of their self-image and their image and the image that the world has of Jewish people. I think that they have been very careful and very deliberate in shaping a view of their community, their group, so that they're thought of in a certain way, which is beneficial for them. I think that what they're trying to do is to make sure that Mr. Sterling is seen as an aberration to the Jewish community. And even the book, How Did Jews Become White? Well, racially, the Ashkenazic Jews have always been white. They've been white since their inception, when Khazars converted to the Jewish religion in the 600 and 700s A.D. And they've had the same attitudes towards Africans that the rest of the white population of the world has had. Here in Baltimore, before the Civil War, there was a rabbi who had to flee for his life to Philadelphia because he was an abolitionist bent. And the majority of Jews in Baltimore were pro-slavery. But what they're doing is a necessary thing for them, because all groups need to define themselves to themselves and to the rest of the world. Huey Newton once said that power is the ability to observe phenomena in nature and to define it in ways that benefit you. And someone else said, and I'm going to ask you if you know who that is, who this person is, said that white people take it as their particular authority to define the world and decide, and to decide what's important in it. Do you know who said that?
No.
I'm going to give you a hint. This person was a 1995 recipient of the William Leo Hansberry Award presented by the United African Movement.
1995. Well, that's probably Amos.
That was you.
Oh, you wow. Said that. It sounded like Amos Wilson.
Yeah, you once said that.
But here's the
and,
thing.
One time on your show, I said,
when we talk about whiteness,
well.
In the context that we historically have been discussing whiteness in America,
mm-hmm.
We talk about it in a socio-political and historical context, and therefore we have to recognize that this is the phenomenon the entire society has been shaped by, whether, and that's the point of this whole story, like I said, whether you, the people in this story have been defined as the key actors or bit players in this story, everything in this story concerns the what's happening in this world in the context of whiteness. And everybody is basically calibrated against that standard of whiteness. Not just the skin whiteness. I'm talking about the power definition of whiteness, which is what is at the base of America. This is why this is a very interesting story to analyze from that perspective, because you have every person recalibrating, readjusting, conceding, doing all kinds of things to accommodate whiteness and to, in their view, make their way to whatever goals they have with this concept dominating everything that they do, their very consciousness. And no one is immune. We all are caught up in it, which is the perniciousness of this thing that we're talking about when we talk about racism. It sounds almost like a pat word, but it is very, very deep. It's a very deep concept. It's a deeply ingrained psychological concept, which is absolutely inextricably linked to this whole idea of dominating people. You dominate and control.
I'm sorry.
So, I mean, when we talk about this, though, I'm saying understand that this is the narrative, and no one, there's no one in the United States who is immune to it. We're seeing how, I mean, and this is fascinating, we're seeing how even at a level that a Donald Sterling is, how much accommodation has to be made to what his consciousness is with respect to how far he can go as a Jewish man in a white supremacist society.
Well, this has been my point. I know I've been consistent about this since I've been calling your program. The whole thing is about white supremacy, and white supremacy, well, to my understanding, there's only one kind of racism on the planet, and that's racism based on white supremacy. And
well, I would differ with you there, because
them.
History is replete with all kinds of interpretations of supremacy. It may not be white supremacy, it may not even be racial. It could be religious supremacy.
In my study of history, I don't see that. I often see nationalism, I see chauvinism, but I never see the idea that the humanity of people is dependent on their being white or their closeness to whiteness. And this seems to be a relatively new construct. The idea of white supremacy requires that African people, being the farthest in general, we're the darkest people on the planet, so we're the farthest from white. So it requires that wherever we are in the world, we have to be on the bottom. And this idea is something that has been defined by white people.
But
and we
again,
have to come to our own definitions of ourselves and the world so that we can recover from the idea of white supremacists.
But
here's the thing.
I understand your point, but you also have to understand that the world is a huge place, and there have been all over the world all kinds of examples of whites treating other whites with incredible cruelty.
Exactly.
And in fact, you have the exact opposite. You have Africans treating Africans with incredible cruelty. So you have to, when you take a look at the Mediterranean slave trade, you take a look at the European slave trade, you take a look at the Islamicization of Africa and the Arab slave trade, you have to understand that it isn't just about whiteness. It is whiteness because we live in the United States, and this has been the formula specifically designed for eternal power by a group of people who came to this land with a mission that stretched far beyond their lifetimes. They saw that, you know, this was where they literally had the ability to be gods. They didn't have that ability in England. They didn't. Here was a chance where they could unleash their awesome power and have it stay, you know, unchallenged for centuries and centuries and centuries. They concocted this thing methodically. You know, Thomas Jefferson wrote a four-page equation, algebraic equation, to discuss when you and at what point you can expunge blackness out of black people. They were obsessed with this notion that race is the sine qua non, the absolute pinnacle of achievement, and with that, because that's what they all shared, with that, how do you absolutely dominate and utterly dominate a society and rule? That was very important. So we have to get to that. When we talk about race in the United States, is that this is, just one second, this is what Amos Wilson was talking about, and that's why I thought you were referring to Amos Wilson. He talks about the power to name things, the power to identify things, the power to control things in their most finite sense. This is the ultimate power. And this is what we mean, this is what I mean when I talk about supremacy. I'm not talking about white people behaving badly and having no manners and being bigots. That is a super simplistic analysis. I'm talking about systemic control over a very long time that is planned. And in this regard, even people who in other societies might have had a kind of a pass because of their white skin, they understood, and this is why we need to get to this conversation that Donald Sterling lets us in on, his understanding of the world he's living in, his understanding in the social sector that he operates in, allows him to interpret his universe, his world, in precise ways as to the limits of what would be tolerated and not tolerated. So let's wrap it up. Go ahead.
Okay. In that, I agree with you, but in my study of history, that, for example, in the Middle Ages in Europe, the serfs were treated, you know, as badly as the slaves were, almost as badly as African slaves are treated, but the idea that people were lesser human beings, I mean, to the extent that they weren't human beings at all, isn't something that, you know, seems to have happened before. And so,
you've got to reread history, because history is replete
with
that idea.
I've read about great cruelty, but, for example, in Africa, if you look at the Bible, Joseph, who was enslaved, became the third highest ruler in Egypt. In Arabia, you had black folks who might have been, who began as slaves and became, you know, powerful people in their areas. This was impossible, you know, with, this is impossible under white supremacy.
But wait a minute.
Okay.
We have a tendency. We have a tendency, and this is something that has to be confronted, the tendency to believe that blacks did not enslave other blacks. The whole idea of the Atlantic slave trade was about black people conquering blacks, treating them less than human, destroying their families, killing and pillaging, and it was an ugly scene.
We can debate that, but the point I'm trying to make is that it's not about debating it.
It is a fact. My point is, there is no concession you can make. When you study history, you have to study what happened without having a vested interest in making it look less brutal than it was. What happened?
I don't want to get sidetracked on this, because my main point is that we have to define ourselves for ourselves.
That is everybody's right. Everybody should define yourself.
This is what I'm saying, and this is what we haven't done. And the best way to do that is for us to study history, to learn about ourselves. Even the man that you had speaking about Latinos, you know, I thought that things that he was saying were kind of distorted because Admiral Farragut's father was born in Mallorca, and Farragut was born in the United States. There was a Don Carlos Buell who was a Union general, and he was born in the United States. His ancestry was Spanish, from Catalonia.
We can't go through history right now.
That's why I don't want to dwell on that. What I'm saying is that the main thing is, and like I last week I classified myself as a recovering white supremacist. We're all born into this regime of white supremacy, and we have to try to deprogram from that, and then we'll be able to define things for ourselves. But right now, we live under white supremacy, and we accept its definitions, and we have to stop doing that.
Thank you, and I agree with that.
Thank you, Utrees.
Thank you. From Dallas, Sarah, you're on the air.
Greetings to you, Utrees.
Thank you, and to you too.
Okay, and greetings as well to the PRN listening audience, and wish everyone an enjoyable weekend.
You know, whenever you say greetings, I'm reminded of my study of Latin in the old days when you had to translate salve, all of the great Roman senators, greetings.
Yes, Utrees. I don't know what the previous dialogue was about because I'm still trying to figure out really what it is because we sometimes tend to get too caught up in semantics and trying to figure out, you know, with what's it. The way I look at it like this, people always like to say, okay, racism doesn't exist. Racism doesn't exist as a social construct. We can all philosophize and say all of these, you know, nice, eloquent things. But the way I look at it right now, in this time and this place and based on perception, I am being discriminated against and I'm being looked at based on me being black, and I don't fit the criteria of white, and there being such a thing called someone being white, and there being a race. So based on how it is right now, and that's how it is that we would like for it to be, this is how the reality that we have to deal with. This is why we as black people, we do not advance, we do not move, because everyone else is seeing race for what it is, and how it's been set up, and how they want to perpetuate it. We want to go ahead and we want to take the high road and bury our heads, don't want to educate ourselves about really what racism is and how it is it has been perpetrated against us.
But you know, doesn't this situation, does it not afford a very instructive eye on how it act, you know, the view from the outside is one thing, that people, you know, have these views because you're African or you're Latino or whatever. But look at how Donald Sterling, I mean, in the middle of all the craziness, there's a certain amount of extraordinarily important information that he has shared, if people care to stop and look at it. He is talking, he is in the belly of the beast, and he is saying, in the world that I have been living in the space that I occupy, uh-huh. as a person who felt compelled to, you know, basically distance myself from my Jewish name and my identity and so forth, because money and being wealthy is important to me. I want to do that. I cannot. I mean, he made this deal with his young lady. You can do whatever it is you want to do, but in the world that I occupy, I know the rules. Mm-hmm. And the rules are, you do not associate with these folks. You don't do that in public. You don't bring them into your home. And by that I mean is home symbolically. You don't bring them that close to you. You do not exactly. maintain these relationships. So this is very instructive, I think. Yes. Because now it ups the ante on the discussion. This is no longer a figment of Black and Latino people's imagination. This is a real construct, at least in his head, with very severe consequences.
And usurpation has always been a very serious construct. But white people play this duopoly with us, telling us, okay, racism doesn't matter, to give you, lull you into this false sense of security that everything is all fine with them, because they are very good in playing this game of, you, okay, we're laughing in your face, but behind your back, is something totally different. And black people have always known, the previous generations, two and three generations ago, we know that, because it was more, racism was more blatant, it was more in your face. But now that you have integrated this past two generations, who have went to school and been in more closer contact with whites, they have lulled themselves into this belief that, okay, everything is fine, it's all in the past, and you need to move on. You don't need to talk about it. But this is what you're seeing is being done. Every day on a daily basis, we're seeing that younger and younger people who are using racial slurs, especially in the age of the internet and social media, where people could get behind their anonymity and they can really post to their heart's content, say and write whatever it is that they really think. And if you read it, you go on blogs, you go on YouTube, so you go on different sites, you see as people really express themselves and say what they have to say. And these are young people. These are not old people, Donald Sterling's age, 80 and so on. These are people who are teenagers and in their teens and younger, because you read about incidents happening in schools all the time where these children are making these racial slurs, hanging black dummies and doing these sort of things.
Yeah, we even had somebody just say something particularly horrid about President Obama.
This
sheriff from New Hampshire. But understand the distinction I'm making. These are social constructs. I'm talking about systems of power.
Exactly.
I'm not talking about, you know, the person who feels, you know, that they feel empowered to be, you know, bigot, or they feel empowered to be racist, or in the sense that we understand. I'm saying the whole discussion needs to be re-examined, because the notions of racism have become quite elemental. We have actually dumbed down on the meaning of it.
Exactly, now you're hearing black people are calling themselves, okay, you're being a racist. So what? No, it's not. It involves systems. If you can control someone's educational or economic means of advancing themselves, you can put laws into place where you can deprive someone of earning a living or being able to live somewhere, as you've heard with sundown towns, and these things are happening to black people. There's nowhere in history where black people have put laws in the book to restrict anyone, white or otherwise, of being able to move mobily or advancing themselves economically. Even on the African continent, where we are in the majority, we have never put anything on any books to restrict white people from moving around and doing whatever it is that they would like to do. It has never happened. We have never ethically cleansed anyone white. So there is a system that they have in place where they have the laws and everything behind laws as well as action to back them up in what they want to do, and that is what is racism. Racism is not me getting on here and me calling somebody else, you know, derogatory names and saying these things. We could always say these things. But
because in the end, you don't have that much power, and I don't have that much power to do anything. But what this man is talking about, Donald Sterling, is talking about he has come face to face, and he has been living with and has had to adapt to. I'm not suggesting that in any way that I'm in any way commiserating with him. I think he is, in fact, a racist bigot. But it just give us just even for an instant, a very nice opportunity here to take a look at what racism means. This is the discussion that is going on in the community.
Exactly.
Thanks, Senator, for your call. You want to finish up?
No, what I was going to say, because he said, like, when she asked him, when you say that black people are treated worse than dogs in Israel, and she said, well, the system is bigger than me. I don't want to change it. I don't want to do anything about it.
And he says, I can't change it.
And he said, I can't change it. And this is what it gets back to, when white people always say, okay, I am not it's not my problem. I don't want to do about it. There's only a few minor ones out here who are doing all of these things. But yet it seems that the majority who are sitting back, who are enjoying the benefits, they're letting these small few minority, as they say in their group, run the system and do whatever they want, and they have no intentions of stopping it because they are deriving a benefit from letting the system continue as is.
But this is my point. This was my point about this whole story. The story itself is about, I mean, the major media, they are protecting a system. The envy, this is when I said the players should have nothing to say. This is up to the system. Bring the system now into focus as to its conduct as an institution.
Exactly.
How, you know, the people are talking about, oh my God, it was a big story. Well, it was a big story in 2006. Nobody paid attention. It's like Snowden suddenly discovers that the NSA is a spying agency. When people have been doing all kinds of somersaults trying to tell the rest of the nation, people said, well, you know, considering the source, we don't have to be bothered with it. Now it is happening to other people who consider themselves outside the realm of consequence. And now it becomes a story.
When it's in their backyard now it's a problem. When it was happening to blacks, Latinos, and everyone else, oh, y'all are just imagining things. But now that you have the actual evidence and you're seeing it happening to you, it's the same with police brutality. When it's happening to everyone else, it's not a problem. But now you see the police are turning on whites and beating them up, like you said, with the movement that they were having to shut down these banks and whatever, when these whites and these young children were being pepper sprayed and brutalized by the police. Now it's a problem. Now that they can say, okay, well, we need to do something about it.
But you know, I would say that the younger people have a better handle on this thing. They understand it in a way that the older generations don't get it quite yet. They have a better handle on it, I think. Thanks, Sarah, for your call today.
You're welcome, Yatrice.
Thank you. From Chicago, Henry, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Yatrice?
Fine, thank you, Henry.
All right. You had a profound conversation with the gentleman from the Economic Policy Institute about education, which is what I wanted to talk about. It was a great, great informational piece that you guys did, but it was also horrifying. The new type of charter school system that, you know, could be coming to a, like I, you know, say, coming to a hood near you.
So, that's right.
Yeah, so the thing is that the war here on education still continues. However, this comes from the state-level front, where earlier this week, Illinois just changed the public school rating system, where now they have lowered the standards for Latino, black, and low-income children and basically mixed them in with, you know, majority white and high upper-class people's test scores now. So generally now that means that districts are not accountable for educating black, brown, and low-income students anymore. Because the thing is that now that you have lowered the standards, mm-hmm. you know, it sort of like makes it like, oh, they're passing even though they're passing with 60%.
So, they're passing within their capacity to pass.
Exactly. So the whole point is that we get these reform educational policies that do nothing to improve education for children. And it is just like sickening to just see this, you know, constantly just go on, and we just accept this, you know, as, oh, wow, you know, they're going to improve our education. When will we learn that these politicians will never improve our education for our children? It is not something that we should be expecting, because the thing is that politicians, you know, basically don't care about education with the exception of making a profit. So the whole point of the matter is that, and going back to this Illinois public school rating system, it generally basically just tells me that the shift of accountability goes away from the politicians, because all they can say is, well, we tried to fix the schools, but they just don't work. Well, I don't know if people, you probably know this, but why is education the only profession in our country where less than 10% of the people who make these policies are actually educators? I mean, you look at every other profession, doctors, lawyers, they have people in that field who make policy. The only people who, you know, politicians majorly make up the policies for education. None of them have stepped in the classroom. None of them have worked in the education field. So I don't know why this is happening, you know, in our country where education is just being, you know, thought.
But you know why. You come from Chicago, where the Secretary of Education comes from. What are his credentials in education policy?
Yeah, he doesn't have any.
What is his highest degree? He has a bachelor's degree in sociology.
He has a bachelor's degree.
Okay.
He has a bachelor's degree. And here's the thing. When CPS reformed, back in 95 as a quote-unquote corporation, because CPS, I think, in this...
CPS
is the
meaning
only,
Chicago Public Schools.
Yeah, Chicago Public Schools, I think, is the only large public school system that has a CEO running the whole ship. Everybody mm-hmm. else has superintendents. Mm-hmm. And the thing is that ever since then, and I think even sometime before that, none of these people who have led the Chicago public school system have never stepped in a classroom before.
And They've how many been, schools have closed in Chicago in the last year?
50.
Okay.
And if you want to go back, a couple of more years, we're going into the hundreds.
This is my point. Yes. And who is the person who selected? I mean, he's of all the people all over this country with serious credentials in education policy and administration, this man gets chosen with a bachelor's degree, and he barely got that in sociology. He gets chosen because he was Barack Obama's basketball buddy. And
well,
he is, those are his qualifications. And he is going to see to it, by the time he leaves, that at least 5,000 schools are going to be closed, more than 97% of them in African-American and Latino communities. He's going to see to it. That's his plan.
Well, Eutrice, you know, the thing is that the choice for, you know, CEO of Chicago Public Schools is no better here, because over the last 4 years, we've had three CEOs who basically, one was the president of the Chicago Transit Authority, which was a failing system here in Chicago. The other guy only lasted, I think he used to run the Massachusetts public school system, and he only lasted for like 6 months. And then we have this new woman, Barbara Burr Bennett, who's just basically a mouthpiece for Rahm Emanuel. So
that's it.
None of these people are background educators. I would love to see at least one person who runs the school system that was actually taught in the Chicago public schools.
It is not going to happen unless people really get wise. Why do they need to get wise? The year 2043 looms. 2043 has been said by the Bureau of the Census, that's the magic year in which the entire United States shifts dramatically in terms of its demographics to a majority-minority nation. You have to have, and they've been putting these things in place. You see the school systems, as our guest yesterday, Dr. Gordon Lafer said, a resegregation of schools. They're not playing. There has to be a coordinated effort to maintain the dominance of the culture that once thought of itself as dominant and to subjugate all others. These things are not happening by chance. They have to create a subservient group so that even if numerically outnumbered, there is a very slim chance of the vast majority of people actually achieving dominance or even equality. Systems are serving the position, they're serving the task now of resegregating. We had a report recently, I'm sure you must have heard it, right here on Lead Stories, about New York being the most segregated city on the East Coast.
And you know, Utrice, I think somebody challenged you on that. Even though I know New York is segregated, you know, I still say Chicago is probably the most segregated city in the country. But, I mean, I'm pretty sure if that's the case, New York isn't that far behind. Here's the question that I'm trying to ask myself is that do we fix the system or do we just create our new, you know, our own schools in our own community?
People have to fight. People have become so timid. They have to fight like these children matter, like their futures matter. When you consider from 1957, the Brown versus Board of Ed, to today, what is the cumulative toll of all these children who for racist reasons had been denied an equal shot at a good education? What is the cumulative toll? So if these things are not important enough to communities for them to say, you know what, it's an all out. We are going for broke here. Everybody out. The Democratic Party has got to go. Look at the damage it has done in Chicago. Who could possibly, with a good mind, vote for the Democratic Party in Chicago or New York City when this is the kind of violence that's being done to innocent children? So yes. If the parents and the community don't get animated enough about this to make these the you know, this is not about me and my political feelings. This is about the future.
Yes, and I agree with you. And I always say this too. You know, you touched upon the death toll of children in Chicago. I always say that anytime a child dies, we lose a piece of humanity.
I tell you, I don't even want to think about it. It's so heartbreaking.
Yes.
Thank you, Henry from Chicago. Good to hear from you.
Thanks.
And keep in mind, you know, spread the word about this new wave. The rocket ship movement that is coming to grab 1 million children. And
oh,
you know,
yes, I will.
They're looking at.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. From New York, Allie, you're on the air.
Hi, Utrice. How are you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. How can the Secretary of Education just could be the Secretary of Education with just a bachelor degree when here in New York City you need a master to teach?
This is the point. You need one in Chicago too. I mean, they have high standards for teachers.
So for the Secretary of
Education, it is okay if you can barely scrape through with a bachelor's degree in sociology. As long as you're a basketball buddy of the president, you get to set educational policy for the entire nation.
Yes, but the reason that I call is because on Tuesday, you had a show talking about Donald Sterling, and one of the things that stunned on me is when you were talking about when did the Jews become white in this country, and in some of the other races, but specifically I'm talking about the Italian. When did the Italian become white in this country? And the reason that I just had that comment is because on that day, on Tuesday, I was listening to a show that sometimes I just go to YouTube and listen. And the gentleman is on the show, usually is on Gary Knowles' show, and his name is Gerald Celente. Gerald Celente made a very racist remark about Trayvon Martin when the case happened. And I knew that Gerald Celente was a very racist man, but I just let it go because I think he's funny and he gives good information about finance, what's happening in finance. So I listened to the show. The show comes, I guess his show is 5 days a week, but you have to pay for it. So I just listened to the show, that whatever it is on YouTube, the latest one. On this day in the morning, I listened to the show that it was on May 7th, but I listened to it on Tuesday before your show. And Gerald Celente, almost at the end of the show, had a remark that it made me turn off the show and say I would never listen to the man again. First of all, when I saw Gerald Celente for the first time, I thought Gerald Celente was either a Latino, a black man mix with Indian and black. I never thought, and also his last name, I never thought that he was a white man. He's a bigot. On that date, on that show, anybody could take a look at that show. It's from May 7th. It's called, you just have to put his name, Gerald Celente, and it's called the Trends Journal. At the end, he was talking about the case that it happened here with Cecily McMillan. Cecily McMillan is that lady from Occupy who got convicted for assaulting a cop in New York on the six-month anniversary of Occupy at Zuccotti Park. And then he went to say that, you know, if that was a white cop, and it was a black woman, you know what it will happen. What it will happen, if right away, it will be racism, discrimination. You know, with that case, and he didn't name the name of the case, but I knew where he was coming from. That case that happened in Florida, remember, discrimination? Because he made a point a few months ago about the same thing. So he was just comparing that if it was a white woman, oh my gosh, she would have never gotten, she would have never been convicted, and they would have been crying about discrimination, racism. The fact of the matter is that our jails are full of brown and black people. So you know, a lot of time these people that they're bigots, they're racist, you can't change their mind because they only wanted to see whatever they wanted to see. And for Mr. Celente, who himself doesn't look white, himself looked like a Latino or somebody who has black blood. Maybe Hannibal, when he was in the Mediterranean in Italy, maybe he's part of that family. But he is such a bigot that
I have not heard any of this at all.
But I'm going to tell you, you could just Google Gerald Celente and go to his Trend Journal from 5-7, and it's almost the last part of his show. You will listen to what I'm telling you. That was my last time listening to Gerald Celente, because when I heard your show, and then you made that very clear, when did the Jew become white? And I'm wondering.
This is the name of a book, How Jews Became White Folks and What That Says About Race in America, by Karen Brodkin.
Yeah.
That was part of the discussion in the community as to, you know, what this whole scenario raises for people to begin to ask these questions among themselves in the community. So
yes,
I will take a look at that, but really haven't heard that.
Yeah, you should, because that's one of the main thing about the Italians. The Italians, especially in this city, and you know the city well.
You, You have to wrap it up.
I just wanted to say that. Thanks so very much. Okay.
Thank you, Ellie.
Okay,
thank you, Harvey and Green and Sarah Henry, and of course Ellie, who just kind of closed us out. We have come to the end of a program. Really great. Thank you for your views, and I wish you the best weekend ever. Now that you've gotten quite a few things off your chest, stay here. Wake Up Call with Richard Martin is next. Reach me at leadstories@gmail.com, on Facebook, Lead Stories with Utrecht Lee. A pleasure and a privilege to be your company.